On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. First topic, the Gabelman probe of the 2020 election extended to the end of April. How do you feel about that? Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who hired the former Supreme Court Justice and extended the probe, had told the Associated Press that the emphasis now is on resolving pending litigation and supplementing the report submitted to Voss nearly 2 weeks ago. So what do you make of former Justice Michael Gabelman's review? Have you read it? How do you feel about this type of state spending? 800-642-1234. Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Molly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back.
So when Gabelman issues this second report, he testifies before the Assembly's Campaigns and Elections Committee earlier this month and says he thinks the legislature ought to take a very hard look at the decertification of the 2020 election. What is his argument?
So the former Supreme Court justice says that there has been enough irregularities in his view, and he is also alleging there has been some voter fraud in Wisconsin. And because of that, he believes that the legislature should look at the idea of decertifying the 2020 election. But that idea is not possible at this point. As soon as those electors were certified in Congress on January 6, 2021, every, you know, legal scholar, constitutional expert, the legislature's own attorneys that I've talked to have said that, that's when that door closed. This idea has, you know, it still has support among, you know, swaths of Republican voters because of arguments being made by Mr. Gabelman and also former President Donald Trump and others who believe that, that idea is still possible. But again, all of the experts that I've talked to have said it's not.
We had asked Assembly Leader Jim Steinecke about Gabelman's call to decertify the election. Here's what Steinecke said.
Even if it were possible, which it isn't, I think it's dangerous to put politicians in charge of deciding elections.
Dangerous to put politicians in charge of deciding elections. Have you heard this sentiment among Republicans?
Well, actually, I've heard several proposals from Republican candidates for governor who want to change the way the state runs elections. And one of the ways they want to do that is to put elections under the Secretary of State office, which is an elected office, so that would be under a politician. And right now, that office has virtually no duties. But the Republican candidates that are proposing this would like to put election oversight and, you know, the administration duties of elections that are currently at the Wisconsin Elections Commission into that office. So he did say that there have been others who, like I said, want to do that, but the legislative leaders at this point, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, say they do not want to blow up the Elections Commission and get rid of that. That Elections Commission is only, you know, a handful of years old. Republican lawmakers actually
started
created
it.
That.
Yes.
Yeah, a few years ago after, you know, the probe into former Governor Scott Walker's campaign and the GAB, they wanted to get rid of that. So they created this new commission.
Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, joining us with state politics and developments. You can join in. What questions do you have about the recent legislative session? What do you think of the Gabelman review to date? 800-642-1234. Molly, Speaker Voss said going forward, Gabelman is going to focus on pending litigation. Can you tell us what open lawsuits there are involving Gabelman's review or elections in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. There are a number of lawsuits still in the courts over his probe. Some of them are related to the subpoenas he has issued. Others are related to the
records requests. There have been a lot of records requests made to his office, and in several cases he has not responded to those requests, or he has not, or he's denied them. And one group, American Oversight, a liberal group named American Oversight, has sued over their denials and non-responses. And so there have been, you know, a couple rulings where the judge has said that you need to start responding to these, and in one case ordered the release of hundreds of documents that the former Supreme Court justice wanted to withhold until the probe was over.
Yeah, and Judge Frank Remington criticized Gableman, saying there's little evidence that Gableman has done any work. What do the records show that Gableman has done in the investigation?
The records that we looked at showed that he, as late as October and November, was still, you know, getting his office set up and making plans for what the probe would really look at. And he was hired by the assembly in the summer of 2021.
May, June-ish area. Uh-huh.
Right. And with the goal of having some report or at least legislative recommendations done by the end of the year. So, and we just, I think, just got an interim report a couple weeks ago. So the judge did not feel like these records, you know, included any information that would have hampered his work, and also made a judgment call that he didn't believe that the documents supported that there had been a full-throated investigation going on.
You mentioned the American Oversight, the government accountability organization. It says the investigation has cost at least $519,000 since its launch. Is there a budget for what's to come, or how much more will be funded by taxpayers?
Well, the total budget is $676,000. That's the budget that the assembly leaders gave the office for this investigation. And, you know, that includes, you know, the work of doing the subpoenas and everything else that he's done. He's also being paid about $11,000 a month in a salary, and also some of his attorneys are getting paid monthly salaries too. And also there's the issue of reimbursements. That's kind of been contentious in recent weeks, with the assembly approving some reimbursements that they've later said that they shouldn't have approved, and now they're going to take that out of his future payments.
Let's go to John in Eau Claire. John, hi, what's on your mind?
Well, every time this subject comes up, it seems to be a one-sided attack on the integrity and performance of Michael Gableman, and that's fair game. But the subject that never seems to get talked about on the liberal media of which you are part is the immense contribution that Mark Zuckerberg made, estimated to be over $200 million, almost all of which went to sway voters toward Biden.
John, thanks. John, I just want to pause there and let Molly to respond, because this was a significant piece of the report, Molly, the Zuckerberg, you know, and those grants.
Yes, that was the focus of the report that was just released in a couple weeks ago. And those grants went to, I believe, over 200 municipalities in Wisconsin, but the bulk of them went to five large cities in Wisconsin. And together, those five cities received $8.8 million, which dwarfed the amounts that went to the other municipalities. And in the former Supreme Court Justice's view, he believes that that money helped sway voter turnout in those cities, which he believes swayed the election to President Joe Biden.
Was there any reason for these grants going to these large metro areas and their voting and election organizations, outfits?
The cities use the funds to buy ballot tabulators and other equipment and purchase ballot drop boxes and pay poll workers higher wages. In those larger cities, there's just more of that work to do.
Mm-hmm.
It also increased the number of early voting sites and mail information about voting to the public. The reason that this became on the or came onto the radar is what happened in Green Bay. There was somebody from the Center for Tech and Civic Life who worked with Green Bay officials and assembly leaders believe that it was improper, the work that he did there.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Molly Beck, our guide to developments at the Capitol, getting us up to speed on the Gableman investigation. Turning to Lincoln Hills, how do you feel about lawmakers finding common ground on building a new facility in Milwaukee County? Do you think the youth prison in Irma should be converted into an adult prison? What legislation did you follow this session? What bill made the greatest impact on your life? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Molly Beck here on the Ideas Network. You are with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state Senate wrapped up its work on the two-year legislative session Tuesday with votes on a proposal to create a new youth prison to replace the troubled Lincoln Hills. We'll get your reaction there. The Assembly, meanwhile, adjourned last month. The legislature could conceivably call itself back into an extraordinary session. So let's just float a hypothetical on that. What would you want lawmakers to take up? Where do you see unfinished business? 800-642-1234. Molly Beck covers government and state politics gavel to gavel for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with us for about 8 more minutes. So Molly, we have the legislature sending the Lincoln Hills legislation to the governor's desk. What does this bill do if the governor signs it?
So this bill requires the teen offenders who are currently in the facility in Irma, which is north of Wausau, to be transferred to a new facility in Milwaukee County. And about $42 million in borrowing was approved, and the Senate and the Assembly both approved this bill, and the governor has signaled that he would support it. So this has happened before. The legislature has passed a bill to, you know, essentially close the facility, which has had, you know, before now, just years and years of very dangerous working conditions for the staff and dangerous conditions for the teenagers who were there too. And back in 2018, the legislature voted to close this and had this new plan that would create two new facilities in its place. And that ended up not going anywhere after the legislature just didn't fund it. And now this is the second attempt at this. And it looks like, you know, the money's been approved. The both houses are on board. The governor appears to be on board. So this looks like it will move forward.
Last month, we talked with Representative Tip McGuire, who's a Democrat from Kenosha, and he praised the proposal to close the juvenile facility. Here's McGuire.
I think it's going to help a lot of these juveniles, as well as their families, remain engaged and allow them to then hopefully proceed without recidivating or committing additional crimes.
Okay, so really focused there on moving it to Milwaukee County. If it is signed into law, this new youth prison has to go somewhere. There has to be plans. Mm-hmm. And does that have to work then through joint finance? What happens then next?
After the governor signs it, the DOC is going to, pick its location. It's already said that it's considering the Felmers Cheney Correctional Center in the Milwaukee area as a location. That seems to be the most likely place at this point, just based on the discussions that we know about. But there is, you know, some opposition in the community there to it, because they believe the current facility plays an important role in helping adult
adult offenders successfully reintegrate into society from prison. Senator Lena Taylor, a Democrat from Milwaukee, she proposed an amendment when the Senate passed it to block the new facility from being placed there specifically, but it was rejected by the full Senate. So, and that's part of why the last proposal didn't happen, because they had considered a site in Ratonia, and residents there really didn't want it to be there. And that lawmakers got involved, and that was one reason why the initial effort failed. So that's, you know, we haven't seen how that's going to play out yet, but it you know, it's moving forward.
So what then would happen to Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake? What would those structures, because there's been talk of turning them into an adult prison.
Yeah, and that's what the new legislation requires. It requires that facility. It's a you know, a sprawling campus. It's in a pretty area, and and right now I don't know what percentage the offenders there make up of the total capacity, but there's not many teens there right now. So it could house, I believe, over 100 inmates. And so that's going to stay open as an adult facility.
Yeah, the census from last week said 53 boys at Lincoln Hills, 12 girls at Copper Lake. So much, much reduced numbers to where it had been in times of real dire conditions.
That's right.
Talking with Molly Beck, cover state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in on legislation, your takeaways from the session, 800-642-1234. So lawmakers ended the regular session last week with the state Senate. How normal is it for the session to end in late February, early March?
It's in campaign years, it's pretty normal. Whenever every campaign year, I get asked that question, and everybody forgets about the last campaign year. But at least since I've been covering the legislature, it's very normal for in election years for the lawmakers to wrap up their work pretty early in the year and spend the rest of the year campaigning. And some people don't like that. They think the lawmakers are drawing a full-time salary. They should be working longer into the year. I've talked to Assembly Speaker Robin Voss about that, and he says that he thinks it's very important to have a bright line between their legislative work and their campaigning. So that's part of the reason why they have that short work period in election years.
Oh, that's really interesting. A bright line separating the time it takes to campaign for office versus the time it takes to work on bills and to get things passed.
Yeah, he says that he doesn't want the public to believe that, you know, what they're doing in the legislature has anything to do with their specific campaign that they're involved in at that point. So
how productive was this session? What were the biggest takeaways?
There was the lawmakers, they passed a number of election bills. Like we talked about earlier, that elections are a big focus for Republican lawmakers right now. They also passed a constitutional amendment that would remove the governor's sole authority over federal spending, which has been a big point of contention over the last couple of years with all the federal pandemic aid coming into Wisconsin. And so Republicans at different points have tried to take control over that funding, and the governor has vetoed those measures. And so the legislature this time has passed a constitutional amendment that would give them more control over that funding. And because it's a constitutional amendment, it has to go through two consecutive legislative sessions and then goes to voters for approval, and the governor cannot veto it. He doesn't have any yes or no authority over that legislation.
Have you seen more constitutional amendment approaches, tactics in this session? It seems like there have been a number.
Yes. Yeah. I would say that's probably true. There was another proposal that Republican lawmakers put forward to change, you know, bail in Wisconsin, and that's in response to the Waukesha parade mm-hmm. attack. The person that was involved in that had been out on a relatively low bail for a very similar crime, and the assembly resolution would amend the state constitution to allow court commissioners and judges to consider the seriousness of the charged crime and the prior criminal record when setting cash bail.
Molly, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck covers state politics and government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Stay with us as the State Capitol Report continues with the administrator of the state's Division of Motor Vehicles. How has your experience been with DMV? 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we head to the DMV. As the pandemic enters year three, the Division of Motor Vehicles has transitioned a range of its services to be handled online, announcing in recent days that more than 200,000 drivers had renewed their license through the online renewal option. That was a pilot program started back in spring 2020. How have your experiences been at the DMV? Do you normally get quick service, or have you ended up waiting? What changes would you like to see at your local DMV? 800-642-1234. Christina Boardman is administrator for the State Division of Motor Vehicles. Christina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Let's start with your January report on service outcomes. You found that you had around 92% of DMV customers who were helped within 20 minutes of their arrival. How is the DMV reducing wait times?
Well, I will admit that during COVID, we have reduced the number of customers coming into our offices. And some of that is customer's choice. We did remove our vehicle transactions from in-person from in-person office visits, because you can do those online, you can do them through the mail or through a third party. So immediately in March of 2020, we did try to reduce the number of people coming into our office. Many things have changed over the last 2 years. We're open to all customers now, but we do feel that our customers over the last couple of years have learned, you know, all of the services that are available online. And we have definitely done a lot of work to enhance what we are providing online to give a range of options for our customers.
But with that said, call volumes have increased. What is the DMV doing to handle the shift to online requests for services and to those call volumes?
Call volumes have increased, as have emails. And so we have done some shifting, and we've done some cross-training throughout the state. So while we may not have as many customers coming into our offices, we still have staff there. And so we have staff throughout the state that are helping in answering those calls, answering those emails. So we've really increased the number of people that are responding to those calls now. Right now, we have an average wait time on the phone of about 2.5 minutes. It's definitely gotten better over the last couple years, and those emails are being answered for sure in 24 hours or less.
What about takeaways for other agencies? I mean, we've seen DWD, Workforce Development, struggled hugely to process unemployment claims. DSPS, the Safety and Professional Services Department, working through a licensing and credentialing backlog. What can other agencies put into practice with what you've done?
We have learned a lot from our customers over the last 2 years. When we immediately transitioned, where we were doing more through the mail and more online or more on the phone, you know, as we were seeing more and more applications come in through the mail, we were saying, you know what, our customers are making a lot of errors on these, which is really just lengthening the transaction because we need to go back to the customer for the correct fee or for the correct documents. And so we took a step back and said, you know, if this is a common theme that, you know, customers are having trouble with this particular application, what can we do to make it better? And so we quickly got some IT resources together, and we call it a smart MV1. It's basically a TurboTax approach to the vehicle form. It, you know, was a 4-page form, very small font, lots of questions, because it was sort of a one size fits all, no matter what type of vehicle transaction you were doing. So we, with the smart MV1 application that's online, it asks you questions one at a time, what do you need to do? And then at the end of that, asking you those questions, you do end up with a fully completed form, which you can then print out. It has the fees all calculated accurately for you, and it tells you exactly what you need to put in the mail. So that has been very helpful. We've also expanded what we're doing with our e-titling. So we had some transactions that you could take care of online through if you privately bought a vehicle, but it was only if you bought a vehicle with a Wisconsin title. Mm. We did expand that application so that if you did buy a vehicle with an Illinois title or a Minnesota title, which we saw a lot of those, you can now do that transaction online as well. So it's really collaborative effort in listening to our customers, figuring out what they needed right then, and getting with our IT resources to quickly put something online that would better meet their needs.
Talking with Christina Boardman, administrator of the Wisconsin Division of Motor Vehicles, you can join in. What questions do you have about the DMV and your experiences using the DMV? 800-642-1234. Andrea is joining us from La Crosse with a question. Andrea, hi.
Hi. My daughter is 19 now. When she went to do her driver's license and learner's permit the first time, she was asked to pick one for race, and she is biracial, and she has never had to pick one on a form before in her life, and she was rather upset about that. And when would this change?
Andrea, thank you. Christina, insights.
Thank you for that question. It's a great question. We have definitely changed that. The form, by statute, we do need to ask for race, so there is a blank on the form. You do not need to pick a particular choice. You can write down whatever you're most comfortable with, and we will accept that. So we have heard from customers that change went into effect a few years ago. If you were asked that most recently, then I'd want to know about that. But we do want to make sure that customers write down whatever they're comfortable with. You do not need to fit into a particular box.
Andrea, thank you for that question. Talking about teen licensing, as Andrea brought up, from spring 2020, you had this pilot program to no longer require teens to pass a road test for their driver's licenses. And so first, the numbers, how many road test waivers have you issued since spring 2020?
Nearly 80,000. So this is a pilot program that's available to 16 and 17-year-olds. Because they are required to have driver's ed. They are also required to have a certain number of hours driving with their parents. Currently, that's 50 hours driving with a parent they have behind the wheel. And so we allow parents, if they are comfortable with that, to go online and waive the road test at the DMV for their child. So we've seen about 80,000 parents make that choice. That is about 88% of the eligible persons. The good news in all of this, number one, it is very convenient, but we've been keeping a very close eye on the numbers from a safety perspective, and we are not seeing a negative safety result as because of taking this waiver. In fact, we are seeing those that have the waiver, they're getting in a crash 3.2% of the time afterwards, while those that are taking the test are at 3.9. So, we were definitely keeping an eye on that, and I'm very happy to report that there are no negative safety impacts of taking that.
So what that you're waiver. Saying is you crunch the numbers looking at the crash rate post-license, the conviction rate post-license through the waiver program, and there the difference then with the rate for the in-person test, and you found that you're seeing better rates through this waiver system.
Yeah, we think we're putting a lot of emphasis on the training. We're putting a lot of emphasis with the parents and that time that they're spent behind the wheel. And we feel that parents are making very responsible choices, and it's coming through in those rates post-licensure. So again, we're looking at just people that are eligible, and we know that they've had driver's ed. Of the 80, there's 88% that have waived the skills test. their crash rate post-licensure is about 3.2%. Obviously, mm-hmm. we want it to be zero. But those that have taken the road test with us, and there may be a variety of reasons the parent or sponsor made that choice, their crash rate post-licensure is 3.9%.
Okay, so the road test waiver still in effect. The legislature didn't make it permanent, nor did it set it to sunset. What is its future?
Well, that's correct. The legislature did not want to make this permanent via the last biennial budget. So it will end. We have the authority in statute. I suspect it will most likely end this year. But we always tell our new drivers, you need to be ready to take the test no matter what. But yes, it will be ending, and we will be reporting on all of the safety data to the legislature.
So if the results are positive, why not continue to waive the road test for new young drivers?
Well, the authority that's given to us in statute definitely sets it up as a pilot with a control group. And so we want to, you know, we want to get a lot of data from this. Mm-hmm. Many states are already doing something like this. It's ultimately up to the legislature if they want to make it a permanent program, but we want to make sure that they have all the information to make that informed choice.
Are there other programs that were pilots or new or expanded over these past 2 years that you see continuing that won't return, you know, once the pandemic fades away?
Well, we do have one other pilot program. It allows people with a driver's license, if they're under the age of 65, they can renew that driver's license online once every other time. That means that you would, instead of needing to go to the DMV every 8 years, you can wait until 16 years. We have had a number of people that have taken advantage of that over the last 2 years, about 200,000. I think you mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. We hit that milestone. Again, no safety impacts. This is only eligible to people that have not had changes in medical history or vision history. But that's been a great program for us. Again, this is currently available in a number of states. And this is another program where we're collecting that data. Virtually zero difference between those that renew online and those that renew in person. And we will be delivering that data to the legislature. And hopefully that too could be considered for a permanent program. It was not included in this last budget, but we'll continue to bring that forward. I think we are hoping that through the pandemic, because we've put these new transactions online, whether it's, you know, titling forms or titling guides to help people, mm-hmm. we have a new phone system that we've put in place where we're collecting more data. We hope that we've really trained a generation of people that instead of when they need to do some sort of DMV business, they'll quickly go to the website to see what, you know, those options are rather than thinking that they need to go to their local office.
DMV Administrator Christina Boardman fielding questions about how services are being handled entering year three of the pandemic. Lessons learned so far. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Christina Boardman here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with DMV Administrator Christina Boardman about services. According to the DMV site, about 750 DMV staffers work at more than 90 locations around the state, handling more than 2 million transactions at these sites while fielding over 1.5 million phone calls and emails each year. How has your experience been at the DMV? 800-642-1234. Christina Boardman with us for about 9 more minutes. Christina, I just rattled off a bunch of numbers for how many people work for the DMV at its sites around the state. We've had such a workforce shortage in many industries. Have you struggled to fill positions or struggled with attrition?
Absolutely. We have struggled just like, you know, many other industries. You know, we try to let people know all of the benefits of state employment, you know, making a difference every day to customers in Wisconsin. But yes, we have had some challenges, especially in the more urban areas where we're competing with a greater number of industries.
So when you say in urban areas where you're competing with a greater number of industries, are you talking about the salary and wages there trying to compete?
Yes, in Dane County specifically, Milwaukee County, I think people just have more options. And yes, we've seen a number of, especially customer service jobs, really up what they're paying on a regular basis. And so we are having that challenge. But yeah, we really try to highlight the great benefits that you can have with Estate. Some of our jobs have flexibility in teleworking. And so we do try to talk about those benefits. But at our service center statewide, we're generally doing a good job. You know, we've had some pockets, but we've also had a reduction in customer volume, so we've been able to manage it so far.
Saul from Stevens Point called, couldn't stay with us, and Saul is wondering why the DMV charges for online licensing and renewal when Saul says they think it costs the DMV less money to do these transactions online.
Great. Thanks for that question. Yes, there is a fee online if you are using a credit card. If you choose to use ACH, which is, you know, including your bank routing number, that service is free. And so we want to make sure that that is available. But if you are using a credit card, there are fees that the DMV incurs that we need to pass along. And so there is a minor fee. I think it's about 1.7% of the transaction, maybe closer to 2%, I'm not sure. But yes, that minor fee is available if you are using a credit card.
Let's talk about CDLs. Back in January, the DMB put a temporary waiver in place to help get more school bus drivers in service, and the waiver lasts until the end of this month. Has that done anything to help get more school bus drivers on the road? What are you seeing there?
Well, the waiver that we have in place right now for school bus drivers is when they go to take their road test, the previous test had kind of this under the hood component where you needed to identify a number of mechanical features of the bus. We found that that just is not a normal part of being a school bus driver. You're just not, you usually are working for a company that may have other people that are handling the mechanical issues. And so it's not a concern on a daily basis. And so the federal government did allow states to make the choice if they wanted to waive some of those under the hood identification components of that road test. And so we have done that. We've seen a number of people take advantage of that. All of the rules for licensing are driven by the federal government. So we need to align with that. But anything that the federal government has done throughout COVID in terms of waivers or extensions or flexibility in Wisconsin, we have taken advantage of all of that to help keep our truckers on the road and hopefully help attract additional school bus drivers.
So speaking of that, the federal government and other commercial driver license developments, there's a rule change at the federal level. Some CDL applicants must meet new training standards due to the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration rule change. What does this mean for entry-level CDL drivers in Wisconsin?
That means if you are coming into the DMV, you're taking your knowledge test to get your instruction permit. And this went into effect in early February. So anyone that was getting an instruction permit after that needs to take driver training with an approved driver training instructor for CDL. We have all that information online. Many, you know, customers were already taking driver training. The driver training schools do need to make sure that they're on file with the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Alliance, FMCSA, that their programs are meeting those requirements. But yes, if you are getting your instruction permit after the date in early February, you are required to take driver training, and those results of that training will stay with your record so that we know that you completed that prior to getting fully licensed.
Christina Boardman with us, Wisconsin DMV Administrator, tackling your questions, 800-642-1234. Mike is with us from Middleton. Mike, hi, what's on your mind? What's your question?
Well, I recently had to renew my license, and I passed the written test, and it took a month before I could do the driver's test. And the guy I had, instructor, I was coming down a residential neighborhood, and I could see like 150 feet ahead of me. It wasn't a hill, but it was a low grade. And I'm 25 miles an hour, and I went through the intersection. There was no stop signs, unmarked intersection. And he wrote me up for that. He failed me for a blind spot and for not slowing down and looking both ways at unmarked intersection. So I went, had to go another month, and then I had a gal as an instructor, and we went through, and it was the same exact roads. Everything was the same. So I slowed down and looked both ways at the same intersection, and she wrote me up for slowing down at an unmarked intersection, unnecessarily slowing down at an intersection. So I'm just curious, you know, who do you go by on something like that? Because I got both receipts from one that failed me and one that passed me.
Mike, thank you for bringing this up. Christina, go ahead.
Yeah, obviously consistency is a real issue. You know, I wasn't sitting in the car with you, but I do know that there are some topics that can be confusing during that road test. And so we always guide people that are taking that road test to really, you know, over exaggerate their movements, whether it's a blind spot check. Those unmarked intersections, yes, you need to be showing caution. I can't speak specifically what happened in your situation, but I appreciate you bringing up the concern of consistency. We are regularly doing retraining. We're looking at the pass fail rates of our examiners, and we're stepping in to make sure that, you know, on those routes we are being as consistent as possible on those tests.
Governor Evers recently signed into law bills that affect car owners. One would require people to buy replacement plates more frequently every 10 years. Another new law requires the mileage of a vehicle less than 20 years old be disclosed before its new owner can get the title. Can you explain why are these laws needed?
Sure. I will start with the odometer one. That was a federal rule change, and we needed to make sure that our state laws kept up with that. But prior to that change, you did not need to disclose the mileage on your vehicle when you when there was a title transfer if it was more than 10 years old. And I think that was probably fine a long time ago, but we know that cars are lasting much longer than 10 years. And so this federal rule and the accompanying state law just make sure that you are disclosing that mileage if it is 20 years or newer. So it just gets more data, make sure that that odometer information is traveling with that car. You know, we've had concerns with odometer fraud in the past, and so this will help address that concern.
And what about the new license plates? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the second issue is the bill, the act that was just signed will require the DMV that if a license plate out there is more than 10 years old, we will automatically replace that at that next year's registration renewal. People may see out on the roads, there are a lot of license plates that are not in good shape. The owner of the vehicle does have the responsibility to make sure that their license is legible, and there's an easy online form to do that to replace your plates. And it was currently $2 a plate, so it's very inexpensive. But you know, we know customers weren't necessarily doing this, so this will require the process, puts the onus on the DMV that at the 10-year mark we will replace those plates and will include the minor fee for those plates. It also puts some increased standards on the plate in terms of reflectivity, etc.
Christina, thank you for joining us.
Great. Have a good week, everyone.
You too. Christina Boardman, Administrator for the State Division of Motor Vehicles. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.